Minister says the future of Europe is at stake in the wake of a surge in the number of migrants arriving from North Africa. And thousands of Australians take to the streets in major cities demanding Indigenous people be given a voice to address the inequalities they face. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. As Libyans grapple with the aftermath of the devastating floods in the country, confusion abounds over the death toll. The Libyan Red Crescent denying a UN report citing the group for a figure of 11,300. The Libyan Red Crescent spokesman says that the organization is shocked to see its name mix up with that toll. It added that these figures add to the confusion and distress of families of the missing. The true death toll remains unknown, with countless bodies swept into the sea. The most recent official death toll, the health minister of the Eastern administration, said that more than 3,200 people were confirmed dead in the city of Derna, and thousands were missing. A week after Storm Daniel hit northeastern Libya, search and rescue operations are going on, but the focus seems to have shifted to helping the survivors. Sudan's capital, Khartoum, is engulfed in flames as fighting intensifies between the paramilitary rapid support forces and the army. According to witnesses, the RSF attacked the army headquarters for the second day in a row as the sound of bombs and gunfire burst through the capital. Fighting has been reported from the south as well. Earlier this week, the commander of the RSF threatened to set up a governing authority in areas under his forces' control if the army forms a government. Sudan's warring factions have been locked in a power struggle since mid-April, which has so far killed around 7,500 people. Nearly 5 million Sudanese have also fled the country. Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso have signed a mutual defense agreement known as the Alliance of Sahel States, and that binds the signatories to help each other in case of any external aggression or armed rebellion. We've discussed that in our news review program.
The military leaders of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger have signed a mutual defense pact as the three Sahel countries seek to help each other against possible threats of an external aggression.
Toute atteinte à la souveraineté.
Any attack on the sovereignty and territorial integrity of one or more of the contracting parties will be considered as an aggression against the other parties and will entail a duty of assistance and relief on the part of all parties.
The pact also binds the three countries to work to prevent or to settle armed rebellions. This comes as the West African Regional Bloc, ECOWAS, has threatened to intervene militarily in Niger over the ouster of President Mohamed Bazoum. Mali and Burkina Faso have responded by saying that any such operation would be deemed a declaration of war against them. Meanwhile, anti-French sentiment is growing in Niger, as Paris insists on supporting the ousted President Mohamed Bazoum. Thousands of protesters have gathered outside of a French military base in the capital Niamey to demand the departure of the French soldiers.
We don't want France today. We don't want France tomorrow. All they have to do is leave our country alone. All they have to do is go home. That's all.
People rallied outside of the French base wearing and waving the country's flag. They expressed their full support for the country's military government. Protesters demanded that Western countries, especially France, respect their choice of government. Niger's leaders have renounced several military cooperation agreements with Paris, saying that French forces are now illegally stationed in the country. France has about 1,500 soldiers stationed there. Julius Baluta is a political science analyst who joins us from London. We also have Jonathan Ofeanza, publisher at Africa Briefing, also joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Julius, first over to you. So you have this security agreements with these three countries, and that's applause to them for realizing that they need to unite in order to thwart off any threat of a possible military aggression against against their country. Do you think that France and ECOWAS perhaps will take heed of the message that this sends?
I think if France was to re-examine its role or contribution to the crisis that we see today in these former colonies, it would definitely support any methods that can make these countries stand on their own. We are 2023, but these former French colonies still have been paying what we call colonial taxes to the tune of $500 billion. And these countries' economies are so horrible. The people are suffering. And when you look into when they are paying that, the GDP, when you combine the GDP of these former colonies, is almost half of that amount. So why is there poverty? Then we can see. And while we see the important role of France coming to aid these countries, we remember 2017, the unity that brought these countries together, G5 Sahel Alliance, to fight against terror, which France was supporting. France was supposed to be helping. That, of course, has come to an end because terror persisted. These countries were the same. Now they've been calling for France to leave. In Burkina Faso, in Mali, they have already left. Niger are still calling for France to leave. So Niger or these three countries find themselves on the horns of a dilemma. On one hand, they are kicking out France. But on the other hand, you have African countries with the ECOWAS, with Africa Union, saying we don't want any coups in the continent. So what do? You can't go to ECOWAS for support. You can't go to Africa Union for support. France, you don't want to see them. So who are you left with? That's why they had to come together. And of course, they thought, for me, I see this as progression of their, or even being a lack that, just saying that, telling ECOWAS, if you dare intervene militarily, we will gang up together. So we can see now they're like making it official, what we call LIPTAC government charter, which now brought them together, is kind of an official agreement that if you are ECOWAS out there, if you are France out there, you see these people means business. They have a kind of an agreement that has brought them together. So they know we have to really show the world we are actually united. But why are they doing that? Because terror persists.
The whole question comes down to this, as to whether you're going to have France or ECOWAS accept the new reality. Really, that's the bottom line here in terms of this phase of what's happened. I mean, coup or not, there's a new reality on the ground, and these countries uniting amplifies that new reality. What do you think? Do you think France and ECOWAS are going to accept this?
There's no choice but to accept, you know, the reality as you put it. And like Julius said in his analysis, look, there's been a groundswell of anti, you know, French sentiment within the whole of, you know, Francophone Africa. If not most of it, the whole of Francophone Africa, right? And there's been, you know, some suspicions of some elements within the French military, even aiding the jihadist insurgencies. You see, so it's a combination of all this, you know, like Gino said, you know, the Francophone countries having to deposit more than 50% of their foreign earnings, foreign revenue, in Paris, okay, and France, you know, still pulling the strings economically. So this groundswell of anti-French sentiment has culminated in this, the establishment of this alliance. And again, like Julio said, yes, it's like these three countries, you know, are caught between a rock and a hard place, okay? They are kicking against France, you know, and they cannot even rely on ECOWAS for protection. ECOWAS has threatened to invade the country, you know, if they don't restore the deposed President Bazoum to power, okay? They've set up a standby military force. That is something I don't see happening because any realistic politician observer knows that any invasion of Niger will plunge the whole sub-region into total chaos. It will actually destabilize the whole region, and even give, I mean, and also boost the activities of the jihadist insurgencies. So what I think these three countries have done, Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, I think it's a right course of action, because it's an act of self-preservation. So I think they are acting in the right direction.
Thank you very much for that. Julius Luta, their political analyst, and Jonathan Ofe Ansa, publisher at Bratfka Briefing, both from London. Thank you. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review.
All right, let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. Italy warning that the future of Europe is at stake due to an increase in immigrants arriving in the continent. The Italian Prime Minister has called for cooperation among all members of the European Union to settle the migration problem. Giorgia Meloni says that the problem could not be solved by Italy alone. She made a comment at a press conference with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. The Italian Prime Minister said her country is under what she called unsustainable pressure. That's after more than 8,000 migrants arrived on Italy's island of Lampedusa in recent days. Nearly 126,000 migrants have arrived in Italy so far this year. That's about double the number of the same period last year. Russia says it's destroyed 7 Ukrainian drones flying over Moscow and the Crimea Peninsula. Defense minister saying that one drone was intercepted over the outskirts of Moscow. According to the mayor, there was no damage or casualty at a site where the debris fell. The ministry added that 6 more drones were intercepted over the Crimea region. Since Ukraine began its counteroffensive in early June, Russia has weathered waves of drone attacks that have sporadically damaged buildings, including in Moscow. Russia, in response, has conducted its own drone strikes, including on Ukrainian capital Kyiv. In Pakistan, economic experts and the business community are urging the government to boost energy trade with Iran so the country could overcome its energy crisis. Our correspondent Nasser Kazemi has a report from Islamabad.
Pakistan has been facing an acute energy crisis for many years. To overcome the energy needs of the country, a national energy conference was organized in Islamabad to explore ways to handle the energy supply deficiency. The conference was attended by energy experts, economists, traders, and political activists. The business community expressed its serious concerns over growing energy deficit in the country, demanding the government to defy the U.S. requests and move to import cheaper electricity and gas supplies from neighboring countries, especially Iran.
We have an abundant resource of energy next door, but due to international political pressures, we are unable to tap that resource, which will be good for our economy plus the economy of our neighbor.
Analysts say the energy crisis poses serious threats to Pakistan's fragile economy and national security environment, urging the government to further strengthen economic ties with Tehran.
Yes, the option is very nice. And we have no other chance other than to connect our all gas-fired power plant with the Iranian gas pipeline. And that is already terminated at the border.
Allah has blessed us with the abundant renewable resources. And if we decide that, okay, we have to go for it, okay, like our neighbors are doing it, okay, in only 5 years, okay, we can go for 100% renewable energy. It's not a big deal.
Meanwhile, Iran's ambassador to Pakistan reiterated that Tehran is ready to help Islamabad meet its energy needs. He said closer energy partnership between the two countries can strengthen their bilateral relations and promote regional stability.
We know that the Pakistani people are in dire need of energy, and we are ready to provide cheaper gas supplies to Pakistan.
Political activists say Pakistan's decision to import cheaper energy supplies from neighboring Iran would offer a promising avenue towards greater economic growth, energy security, and environmental sustainability.
Expanding energy trade with Iran will not only foster economic and diplomatic ties between Islamabad and Tehran, but will also help Pakistan to modernize its infrastructure, and harness its energy potential more effectively. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Now thousands of Australians take to the streets in major cities to rally support for the October 14th referendum on whether to recognize First Nations in the Constitution. The Walk for Yes demonstrators marched in Sydney, Melbourne, and capital Canberra, among other places. They held signs demanding that the Indigenous people be given a voice to address the inequalities they face. That's through constitutional rights to be consulted on policies that affect them. The Indigenous now have shorter lives than other Australians. They have poorer education and are far more likely to die in police custody. The rally came as the reforms are losing public support, with just 40% backing it, a turnaround since a year ago. Israeli forces have attacked Muslim worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds. The troopers assaulted and beat up three worshippers near one of the main entrances of the compound. Regime forces have intensified their presence around the Al-Aqsa Mosque and prevent the entry of Palestinian citizens. Meanwhile, scores of settlers have entered the compound. This latest incident adds to the tensions surrounding the mosque. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has vowed to defend the holy place against the Israeli incursions. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The United States is reportedly set to approve arming Ukraine with longer-range missiles that are packed with cluster bombs, despite widespread concerns that they can cause indiscriminate casualties among civilians. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. China Daily wrote, Representative Hula Han, a Pennsylvania Democrat and co-chair of the bipartisan Unexploded Ordnance UXO demining caucus, chided, the decision to provide cluster munitions cannot come at the expense of American values and democracy. In order to prolong the war in Ukraine, the United States regime is arming Ukraine with everything it has, from financial aid up to tens of billions of dollars to all sorts of weapons such as the HIMARS rocket systems, F-16 fighter jets and even cluster munitions, which has stoked controversy internationally. The use of cluster bombs can cause humanitarian problems, as the large number of bomblets it releases are prone to cause accidental injuries with indifference between combatants and civilians. Furthermore, cluster munitions produce a large number of unexploded dots, which are extremely dangerous to children who might mistake them for toys and get hurt by a delayed detonation. Cluster Munition Monitor 2022 identified at least 149 cluster munition remnant casualties in 2021 globally, with children accounting for roughly two-thirds of them. For a long time, the United States has regarded cluster munitions as legitimate weapons with clear military utility and is infamous for using them in many of its wars, from Vietnam, Laos, the Persian Gulf, to Kosovo and Afghanistan. Yet, in the ongoing conflict in Eastern Europe, Washington's position on cluster bombs has been unashamedly inconsistent. At the early stages of the conflict, the U.S. regime firmly opposed the use of cluster bombs. White House Press Secretary Psaki and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Greenfield made clear that cluster munitions are extremely lethal weapons, and that if Russia uses cluster munitions, it would potentially constitute a war crime. Late last year, NSC Coordinator for Strategic Communications Kirby noted U.S. concern about Ukraine's request for cluster munitions. Senior U.S. State Department officials also called for mines such as cluster munitions not to be laid in Ukraine in an irresponsible and barbaric manner. However, just a few months later, as Kiev's counteroffensive turned frustrating and the supply of conventional weapons became insufficient, Washington's attitude began to take a U-turn. In June this year, the U.S. Department of Defense suddenly declared that cluster munitions were particularly suitable for attacking Russian defense bases. And in July, President Biden, despite the controversy and strong voices of opposition, finally made a difficult decision to transfer cluster munitions to Ukraine. To ensure Kiev gets the bombs, Washington has gone so far as to circumvent domestic legal restrictions. According to the Consolidated Appropriations Act of U.S., it is not allowed to sell or transfer cluster munitions with a dot rate higher than 1%. However, the bombs transferred to Ukraine have a dot rate of about 2.35%. The White House invoked Section 614 of the Foreign Assistance Act and used the special presidential immunity and authority to greenlight the transfer. Like in Cambodia, Laos, and Afghanistan, the cluster munition remnants left in Ukraine will be a nightmare that will haunt its people for a long time to come. Apart from security threats, the remnants will seriously affect the resumption of agricultural production in Ukraine. The Kiev government assessed that Ukraine, as a major global exporter of cereals, already had some 160,000 square kilometers of land contaminated by latent munitions, including large areas of agricultural land. It would directly affect the global food supply and exacerbate the world food crisis. Washington's two faces on the issue tell us again that Uncle Sam doesn't take any international norms, rules, or obligations seriously, nor does it care about the lives of Ukrainians or peace for Ukraine. The Ukraine war has become a game that the U.S. regime is willing to win at any cost, most of which will be borne by the Ukrainians, of course. Meanwhile, Press TV reported, according to a recent report citing three unnamed U.S. officials, Washington is considering shipping either or both Army tactical missile systems that can fly up to 190 miles or guided multiple-launch rocket system missiles with a 45-mile range packed with cluster bombs. Ukraine is currently equipped with 155-millimeter artillery with a maximum range of 18 miles, carrying up to 48 bomblets. The ATACMS can fire around 300 or more bomblets, while the GMLRS rocket system is capable of dispersing up to 404 cluster munitions. The report said if approved, either option would be available for rapid shipment to Kiev. The munitions are expected to be used against Russian forces present in those Ukrainian territories which have voted to join Russia since the onset of the conflict. Washington has allocated more than $40 billion worth of military aid to Kiev since last February when the crisis started. Cluster munitions generally eject bomblets that can cover five times as much area as conventional bombs. They are banned under the Convention on Cluster Munitions, CCM, because unexploded bomblets can pose a risk to civilians for years after the fighting is over. The CCM, which took effect in 2010, bans all use, production, transfer, and a stockpiling of cluster bombs. More than 100 countries have signed the treaty, but the U.S., Russia, and Ukraine are yet to join. Last month, Russian ambassador to Washington, Anatoly Antonov, lashed out at the U.S. regime over its support for Ukraine's use of the globally banned munitions, noting that the bombs have already killed a Russian journalist. Antonov slammed Pentagon Press Secretary Pat Ryder for the latter's earlier remarks, claiming that the U.S. has all indications that Ukraine is properly employing the cluster munitions. Antonov said attempts by U.S. officials to portray Ukraine's use of controversial cluster munitions as appropriate and legitimate are shameless and outrageous, adding, "I would like to know whether the proper use of cluster bombs is also true for the assassination of Russian journalist Rostislav Zhuravlev." According to New York Times, President Biden's decision this summer to send the munitions to Ukraine after pleas by President Volodymyr Zelensky drew widespread condemnation, and even some close American allies were critical. Cluster munitions have been banned by more than 100 countries because of either devastating effects, sometimes years later, on children and other civilians who mistakenly disturb and detonate unexploded rounds.
Ocean of Dua.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach toward supplication, and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran, and we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Dear listeners, as you were previously with us, we were discussing the different constituents of supplication. The third constituent to be discussed was God, whom we ask for a favor. As we concluded in the previous episodes, we said that knowing God has effects on the believers who take part in supplication. And this knowledge is what influences the hastiness of acceptance of supplications by the Almighty Allah. Once we read in the traditions that once some people asked Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, why is it that we invoke God, but our supplication is not responded to? In response, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, لِأَنَّكُمْ تَدْعُونَ مَنْ لَا تَعْرِفُونَهُ. You invoke the one whom you do not recognize. So, as we said, the first important condition in the acceptance of supplication, when it comes to this third constituent, is the recognition of the Almighty Allah, ma'rifah, and knowing Almighty Allah. We said that we have to know Allah as He really is. Ma'rifatullah haqqa ma'rifati. And this is what, based on the traditions, will move the mountains with the supplications. This is the power of supplication, of course, on condition that it is added with ma'rifah and recognition. Later on, we said that in one important tradition in Uddatu Da'i, narrated by Muhammad bin Ajlan from the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, it is narrated that Allah the Almighty revealed to one of His prophets concerning His guardians, وَعِزَّتِي وَجَلَالِي لَأَقْطَعَنَّ أَمَلَ كُلِّ آمِلٍ أَمَلَ غَيْرِي بِالْيَأْسِ. I swear by my magnanimity and honor that I will cut the desire and wish of anyone who relies on other than me, and I will dress him in the dress of ignominy among people. I will deprive him of my favors. So, based on this tradition, we said that sincerity of supplication is one important thing. This needs to be discussed in details, and this is what we are going to discuss from now on.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. so that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the merciful God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you, Allah, that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God speaks with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. Feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
We had a look in the previous episode at this verse. فَإِذَا رَكِبُوا فِي الْفُلْكِ دَعَوُوا اللَّهَ مُخْلِصِينَ لَهُ الدِّينَ. So when they ride in the ships, they call upon Allah, being sincerely obedient to Him. فَلَمَّا نَجَّاهُمْ إِلَى الْبَرِّ إِذَا هُمْ يُشْرِكُونَ. But when He, subhanahu wa ta'ala, brings them safe to the land, they associate others with Him. We said that sincerity in supplication is one of those important conditions. This needs to be observed, and we should be aware that the absolute cause is God. This is what comes out of sincerity. This is the core meaning of sincerity. We should not associate Him with anyone else. And sincerity is the absolute attention to this real cause that we have come to know prior to engaging in supplication. Therefore, associating anybody or anything with Allah is considered impermissible. If we see that our request, our want is satisfied, we should know, we should recognize that we have resorted to God and no one else. Then the meaning of that heavenly tradition becomes clear. If one resorts to anybody other than me, my favors will not reach him. So in these situations, when these causes have satisfied one's needs, it is because of Allah. And this is really important. Now, based on this verse, فَإِذَا رَكِبُوا فِي الْفُلْكِ دَعَوُوا اللَّهَ مُخْلِصِينَ, the strange thing is that man has not previously believed in God, but now he sincerely calls upon Him. دَعَوُوا اللَّهَ مُخْلِصِينَ, the verse says. And this is really interesting. Elsewhere in the Holy Quran we read, قُلْ أَرَأَيْتَكُمْ إِنْ أَتَاكُمْ عَذَابُ اللَّهِ أَوْ أَتَتْكُمُ السَّاعَةِ أَغَيْرَ اللَّهِ تَدْعُونَ. Say, tell me, if the chastisement of Allah should overtake you, or the hour should come upon you, will you call on others beside Allah? This is what will happen if the one who is engaging in supplication is not recognizing Almighty Allah as the absolute cause. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Andrei Kostin, CEO of Russia's second largest bank, VTB, has said the Global South should establish a new financial system to mitigate the risks posed by the West. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Andrei Kostin, CEO of Russia's second-largest bank, VTB, told RT on the sidelines of Eastern Economic Forum recently, "The dollar and the entire Western financial system built around it has been jeopardized by the sanctions on Russia." Asked about Russia's push towards switching trade to national currencies, Kostin responded that it is done out of necessity rather than a targeted attempt to undermine the greenback. He stated, "The dollar is illegally used as a weapon. It should not be done like this. We are talking about finance and the economy. Why should it be used for other purposes than this? It should be free from political and geopolitical risks. That's the only reason for de-dollarization." To illustrate his point, the banker quoted a famous phrase from the Godfather movie, "Finance is a gun, politics is knowing when to pull the trigger." He explained, "And that is what we saw. The politicians in the West pulled the trigger and it's been used against Russia. And not only Russia, but other countries." Kostin noted that while a decade ago nobody wanted to use local currencies in cross-border transactions and were content with using the dollar, now more and more countries are re-evaluating this stance. Kostin said, "We raised the question of using local currencies 10 years ago, but nobody wanted it at the time. Why? They said, we can use the dollar. It's good. And it was good until we faced the situation when America started to threaten us, threaten other countries, saying, if you don't do this, if you don't do that, we will cut you off from the dollar. If they had not behaved like this, we would never have raised this question." Kostin said that it is high time for countries in the Global South to create their own financial system based on national currencies. He stated, "It is the right time for the Global South to start to build up this system because, though the Global South removed the colonial system politically after the Second World War, the colonial system in the financial sector still exists. The empire built by the U.S. with the help of its allies still works." Kostin added that it is now very clear to the most of the world that if we continue like this, there will be a threat of the U.S. using the financial system as a weapon. The banker noted, however, that the idea is not to fight the Western financial system, but to build a parallel system that will work to the benefit of the Global South. He said, "We see big changes in the balance of economic power in the world with such countries as China, Arab countries. And that allows us to create a different system which would be based on different principles. Principles of independence, sovereignty, the use of currencies other than the dollar and euro." Kostin first outlined his idea for a new financial system at the Financial Congress organized by the Russian Central Bank in July. His proposal included four primary principles: replacing SWIFT with a new messaging system, replacing U.S.-linked correspondent relationships among banks with horizontal links among local banks based on blockchain technology, creating an international depository settlement hub in the Persian Gulf to replace EU-based Euroclear and Clearstream, and creating new instruments for raising capital instead of using foreign currency bonds that are linked to the West. According to Sputnik, the process of de-dollarization on a world scale will be neither a fast nor an easy one, but it is definitely possible in the future, the dean of the Faculty of International Relations at New Era University said. Speaking on the sidelines of the Eastern Economic Forum, EEF, Carlos Tabunda noted that de-dollarization has become the buzzword of late amid the tectonic shifts taking place in the global economic order. Participants of Russia's 8th Eastern Economic Forum, EEF, hosted in the city of Vladivostok from September 10 to 13th, have similarly been weighing in on the prospects of cutting back global reliance on the greenback, Sputnik reported. Many countries remain tightly linked to the American greenback, said the Philippine expert, which explains why the de-dollarization process is still a big challenge. China and Russia, along with other nations spearheading the de-dollarization process, still have a long way to go before reliance on the greenback can be toppled, Tabunda continued. Ways to sidestep the dollar and Western-dominated financial institutions via expanded trade in local currencies have been among the key items on the agenda of last month's three-day summit of the BRICS group of major emerging economies, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, which wrapped up on August 24th in Johannesburg. The gathering ended with an announced expansion with Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Ethiopia, Argentina, and the UAE invited to join the club. At the event, BRICS stressed the importance of encouraging the use of local currencies in international trade and financial transactions between members of the group as well as their trading partners. This shift from dollar use took on a new significance amid expanded weaponization of the major reserve currency by Washington in order to achieve its geopolitical objectives. Furthermore, the dollar's increasingly perilous global position amid prospects of a recession in the United States has also fueled the dollar-ditching debate.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very interesting question, and that question is regarding polytheism, or shirk. As you know, polytheism is a very important and significant topic. It's been talked about in the Holy Quran in many places. And as you know, it's such a grave sin that it's been mentioned in the Holy Quran that all sins can be forgiven by God, meaning without repentance, except polytheism. So if a person dies having committed polytheism and he hasn't repented before he dies, you know, God will not forgive such a person. God will not forgive such a person. But the question we want to ask here today regarding polytheism is, where exactly does polytheism begin? You know, a lot of times people, there are certain sects within Islam, especially these days, and they point their finger to the actions of other sects, and they say that, you know, what you're doing is shirk, this is shirk, that is shirk, this is polytheism, that is polytheism, right? And because of that, you know, this is, you know, something that they say, and a lot of them, you know, they actually become, you know, they physically, you know, they become very harsh towards the other party. You know, they might even actually, you know, take it to the extreme and say that this person should be killed, and so on and so forth. So the question we want to ask today is this: where exactly does polytheism begin, and what is the minimum degree of polytheism? Let's put the question in that way. So this question, we can take inspiration from the hadith of our Imam alayhi wasalam for an answer to this. Fortunately, once Imam Sadiq alayhi wasalam was asked about the absolute minimum degree of polytheism. What was it? To which he responded in the following way. It is to contrive a ruling. It is to contrive a ruling, and because of it, to take side with people or against them. This is one of the minimum degrees of polytheism is. And in another hadith has been narrated in Imam Bakr alayhi salam, he once said that it is to call fruit kernels stones and vice versa, and to believe them to be such. These are some of the minimum degrees of polytheism. Of course, polytheism, it also has hidden aspects, or there's a hidden form of polytheism. For example, the Prophet said, beware of committing anything that warrants justification, for verily that is where hidden polytheism lies. And Imam Sadiq again, he said that polytheism is more discreet than the crawling of an ant, and this includes things like turning one's ring to remind oneself and other such superstitions, right? So basically it's kind of these kind of superstitions that, you know, exist in all cultures, right? These are acts of polytheism. But right, if there is something which has been transmitted from the Prophet via his children, via his grandchildren, such as the A'imma alayhi wasalam, then you know, there's no polytheism in it, because it's not a superstition, rather it's a portion of religion itself. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the minimum degree of polytheism in the light of the hadith. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Philippine Red Crescent denies a UN report citing the group regarding the flood death toll in the country. It says these figures only further distress the families of the missing.